entities, NGOs, and so forth. It must be clear that our embarking on public hearing is part of the roadmap towards eventually engaging with the Department of Energy itself, such that as informed and influenced by this public hearing, through this Parliament, we can make recommendations to the Department of Energy, such that its revised strategy on energy efficiency will take on board the inputs that will be made as from today until Friday. So I trust and hope that all those who are here today will take our exercise today onwards very, very seriously. This is an area which, as South Africans, we would definitely have to acknowledge we've been moving rather slow. For those who have been exposed to the current energy efficiency strategy, which is supposed to be driven by the Department of Energy, one will realize that we are far from getting any closer to the targets that are set in the strategy. In each and every sector, whether it's industry, agriculture, household, I can't remember all those sectors. So it is important then that this committee facilitates in an expeditious way a movement towards realizing that we are practitioners of energy efficiency in the country. We don't just have energy efficiency strategies and programs and paper. No matter how much explanation can be given, at the end of the day, we are a country that's not just water scarce, but it's also energy scarce. So, as they say, one of the low-hanging fruits is to ensure that we meaningfully and intensively embark on energy efficiency practices. So, on that basis, I welcome everyone who is come to make oral presentations today. I really, on behalf of the committee, value taking the time to come and share your views for us with us. Having said that, can I then get apologies from the committee secretary?
Thank you, Chairperson. We've only received one apology from Honorable Ferguson, who is attending the Portfolio Committee on Water and Environmental Affairs meeting.
Thank you very much. The lineup today is Sane D and C, VW, Saint Cobain, I hope I'm pronouncing this properly, Mr. Kutsie, and Bert Industrial. That's for today. Today, on November was half a day, because this is a committee week. Usually, during committee week, we have certain days to ourselves. So we'll be taking half a day for today. Can I then welcome Sunny D, Mr. Brayden Cup, to make a presentation. Thank you.
Honorable Chair, Honorable Ministers of Committee, members of the committee and members of the public, good morning and thank you very much for this opportunity to be able to speak to you today on specifically the topic of measurement and verification of energy efficiency which I think leads in very well to some of the comments that the Chair has made in the opening comments. This is a fantastic opportunity for us to share ideas on this very topical matter of energy efficiency, and I think the presentation that I'm about to talk about brings it all together in terms of measurement and verification or quantification of the benefits and the savings that have been achieved. Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, in the context of this presentation, it's important to note that energy efficiency encompasses a far broader spectrum than just electricity efficiency. I know I'm talking to the converted now, but I think far too often when we talk about energy efficiency, because of the current situation we have with Eskom, we tend to just think about electricity efficiency. Those who stood in queues to fill their petrol tanks last night before the price went up also realised that things like liquid fuels, LPG gas, other energy carriers, all part of the mix. And if you really want to achieve energy efficiency benefits, we have to look at it in totality and not just electrical energy. Secondly, we are probably all familiar with the old saying that says, if you can't measure it, you can't manage it. We've heard that over and over. So by way of introduction, I would like to just ask a question. This is a rhetorical question, I don't expect an answer. And given the situation we've had since 2008 when we had rolling load shedding, when we had the major impact where we had to experience the effects of not having electricity, not having access to energy because it wasn't only electricity, because of the electricity crisis, the refineries had problems, and we had LPG gas shortages, we had various other problems. My question would be, how energy efficient has South Africa become since 2008? Or in another way is, how much energy has South Africa saved specifically through energy interventions over the same period? Not necessarily just switching off the lights, which is energy efficient, but that's more conservation. I'm talking about targeted interventions where we've actually physically done something, receiving some form of funding or grant. And unfortunately, if I show you this graph, which is sourced from Eskom, it shows you a picture of various demand savings over the period, actually before that. And if you look at 2008, 2009, you see the demand savings achieved. But I think it's important to note the footnote at the bottom, which just says DMP, demand market participation. And that's where Eskom is actually paying people not to use electricity. So the amount of, or the rate they're offering is a phenomenal rate. It's an offer that cannot be refused. It's like Eckers would say, red hanger sale. So when there's a crisis on the system, they offer customers a vast amount of money not to use electricity, largely the industrial customers, and that's why you see those savings. But those are electricity savings, and it does say non-funded projects, but I must also add non-funded projects that Eskom are aware of. A lot of us are doing very good work in energy efficiency, purely as a result of the increase in electricity tariffs, not waiting for funding from Eskom or government or tax incentive, but just because we can't afford to pay the electricity. So we're doing projects, we're seeing the private sector doing phenomenally good work purely to affect the bottom line. And those savings are not captured in that picture. So, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, the answer, I would go as far as saying that those figures, or if anyone answered the figure as to how much energy we've saved, I would say in no uncertain terms that would be, and I would categorically state that on the record, that would be a lie, or it would be a calculated guess. We don't know how much energy we've saved, you know, on an aggregated basis. And why am I saying this? There's no existing platform to consolidate all the results of all the initiatives that are happening, and that's why I emphasise in the written paper that these exceptionally good work being done. I think everyone's coming to the party. We're seeing through 49M, we're seeing a movement towards everyone really playing their part in contributing to this energy crisis that we've had. But if at any given time the Minister or the Chair would like to say, to know what have we saved, you'd have to phone people in all those areas and then sit with the calculator, add them up and make sure that you haven't double counted because the person might have had a tax incentive and done some private sector funding, and it's just one nightmare. So we don't really know what's happening. And some of the initiatives I've listed, I'll speak to them in a bit more detail, is the NERSCOM Eskom funded projects, which is primarily the main source of funding for energy efficiency in the electricity sector, We have the 12 are industrial tax incentives. SANS 204 and 10400 are indicated in red. And why I've done that is those are the standards that have eventually been built into the building regulations, which are compulsory, the compulsory building regulations. It took approximately 10 years to develop those, long before the energy crisis, to get energy efficiency built into the building regulations, which happened in the beginning of this year. It was promulgated by the DTI that certain building alterations have to have a certain measure of energy efficiency included in it. And why I put that there, I was invited 2 weeks ago to go and speak to a conference on at the National Fenestration Council. And these are the people that look specifically at glazing doors and windows. And they were really doing presentations on what they're achieving through the building regulations. An example in the building regulations says now, if 15% of your building if more than 15% of your building in relation to the surface area of the building has got glass in it, you have to install double glazing. And we always used to say in the past, South Africa's climate doesn't warrant double glazing. It's only in Europe in those extreme climate. Europe and those places have moved on to triple glazing of windows. Now, windows we take for granted. You know, we think of light bulbs, we think of air conditioning. But the amount of savings that can be achieved just through having the right windows, the right size of the windows, the right orientation of the windows, the right position of the windows. And the building regulation says, if you take 100 square meters, if you've got a building of 100 square meters, if you've got 15% more than 100 square meters of glass in your windows or in your design, you have to then install double glazing. Now this was a huge, huge achievement to get this built, the building regulation. And my question at the end of the conference was, this is good stuff, but today, as a result of this, we put a lot of burden on the building control officers in the municipalities who have to approve the plans, but also have to approve energy efficiency plans. I said, how much have we achieved in terms of savings? They said, no. We just measure compliance with the building regulation. We don't measure what we've achieved. So I said, why have we spent 10 years in developing this, but we're not measuring the impacts? You know, or highly improbable, but we could be actually going backwards. We might be doing something wrong, and no one's measuring it because we now have a regulation and we only measure compliance to the regulation. We're not measuring the impact of that regulation. And then there's things like the Industrial Development Corporation. We now are receiving huge sums of money for the green economy, the DBSA funded projects. Commercial banks are funding energy efficiency in a big way now. Public buildings, big drive to make all public buildings energy efficient. And then, as I said, unfunded projects just for pure economic reasons. We have a number more city sectors. We have the Green Building Council doing phenomenal work. We're doing lots of initiatives. But no one's measuring and verifying all of that in a consolidated way. And it's a pity because South Africa has the perfect enabling environment to actually have a bigger picture in this area. We have an approved national standard that actually tells you how to do measurement and verification. It's a standard that you have to comply with to do a measure and verify and report on energy savings. Similar to the environmental people, they have the MRV process in terms of greenhouse gas emission, and they're developing a greenhouse gas emission inventory on a national scale. SANS 50010 is the blueprint on how we should measure them, and it makes provision for lots of variables. But unfortunately, right now, on the Eskom programs, the whole measurement and verification environment is limited to 7 universities countrywide. This is, first of all, not enough people to cope with the demand, and secondly, it is creating this exclusive zone of measurement and verification professionals. And we're not opening it up to the broader impacts that we can achieve by creating jobs, by having lots of measurement and verification practitioners in the country who just have to work according to SANS 50010. So, Chair, because it's limited to the 7 universities, a lot of people sit back and say, now, measurement and verification, it's rocket science. It's not. With the standard in place, it gives you a blueprint, it gives you the tools, it gives you the calculators to actually do the determination of baseline and adjusting baselines, etc. So it's becoming more and more important to the quantum of money that's being invested in energy efficiency. And these are phenomenal amounts of money. If I just use an example, getting back to the Eskom example, Eskom received 5.4 billion rand through the last MIPD to give away in terms of energy efficiency. Was approved by the regulator, and then we know MIPD3 was due last Friday. It's been extended by a month, where there'll be another tranche of money requested for energy efficiency implementation to the broader public. Now, this is ratepayers' money. This is money that you and I pay, whether we're in a municipal zone or in an Eskom electrified zone, is a small surcharge on our tariff that goes into this 5.4 billion rand fund. That's a phenomenal amount of money to be given away. We also have a 20 billion rand allowance for the 12 our industrial tax incentives on energy efficiency. But that's not actual real money. It's 20 billion rand as a tax allowance in terms of foregone tax. So the real impact on the business equates to around about 8 billion rand. But these are big figures in anyone's books. The funding period is over a three-year period, and it's required to deliver 1,000 megawatts and 4,055 gigawatt hours of electrical energy savings. Now I say electrical energy savings, not looking at the other sources. The MNV function to ensure that these targets are indeed achieved currently resides within Eskom. So Eskom now becomes the player, the referee, and the third umpire. And I'm not questioning or in any way trying to insinuate that Eskom would crook the books or not give the right figures. But I think if you're looking at it from a transparency point of view, this is not correct, and it's not taking the bigger picture into consideration. And that brings me to the gaps here, is that the bigger picture is broader than Eskom. The bigger picture is broader than electricity. If I take, for example, the 1 million solar water heating target, the minister has announced that target. We have Eskom doing a program. We have a DORA-funded project where the fiscus is providing for low-pressure systems to low-income houses. We have a number of municipalities doing their own programs on solar water heaters. And all we're measuring is the ones that Eskom are doing and the DORA-funded ones. There are a lot of people, residents, like myself, that would just go and put a solar water heater on because it's the right thing to do and it's going to save me money. So when we talk about progress towards the million solar water heater target, you're saying we can install about 200,000. We're probably close to double that if you take everything into consideration. So once again, I'm giving the impression that we're not looking at the bigger picture. We also bring in fact that the chair mentioned this morning about a water scarce country and electricity scarce country. We're just measuring a million solar water heaters in specific areas. But the impact that is having, especially on poorer communities, is that we say we're giving you free hot water, which in an energy sense is true, because it's hot water from the sun. But these residents have always lived without a hot water system. They would go and possibly fill a bucket or a container and use that for washing and so on. Now we're giving 150 litres solar water heater to these people, which is fantastic in terms of quality of life, etc. But we need to be honest and communicate with people, because water is an expensive resource, as is electricity. So where the person might have used 15 litres of hot water a day, they now could use 150 litres, and they have to pay for that water. Now we say we're giving you free hot water from the sun, electrically speaking, energy speaking. But we're not telling the people that now your water bill is going to probably increase 3 times the amount of what it was previously. And that is taking into consideration the bigger picture. Not just solar water, because from an energy point of view, we've got a million solar water heaters, and we say it's 3,000 megawatts. But what about the impact on the water resources and the affordability and ability of people who are receiving the solar water to pay for that increased water bill? And that is not taken into consideration. That's why I say we need to look at it in totality. The whole program is focused on electrical energy, and it includes socioeconomic impacts. Because we have an energy crisis, or an Eskom crisis, we look at megawatts, and you saw that graph that's published, says we've achieved so many megawatts and so many gigawatt hours of that. How many jobs have we created in that, or how many jobs have we lost? Because now, maintenance people in this building, for example, if you make all the lights energy efficient, we would previously have someone changing light bulbs. Low school person walking around changing light bulbs probably every 3 months, because the inefficient lamps fail fairly regularly. Now you're putting a 50,000 hour LED light, for example. That light will not have to be changed for another 5 years. What happens to those people now that you still have a light bulb changing? I'm using a very simple example that does escalate to a bigger picture. Are these people being retrained? Are we losing jobs in the sector, or are we creating jobs in the sector? What are the environmental impacts in the sectoral economics? Once again, it's a free-for-all. It's a rand per megawatt. If you can save a megawatt or kilowatt hour, whether you're an industrial customer, an agricultural customer, or a residential customer, the message is we need megawatts. But why are we not prioritizing? If you look at the sectoral impact, maybe the textiles industry, which is really battling, needs to get a bigger incentive then the second and mining, I'm just using examples. We need to understand the economics of this, because we might be incentivizing, we might be providing perverse incentives in a sector that doesn't need it, that's already declaring huge profits of billions of rand. But we have another sector that's declining, losing jobs, like for example the textile sector. A sector, should we not be incentivizing them from an energy efficiency point of view more than the other sectors that are really booming? And it's not that case right now. So it also includes the negative implications of the supply and demand for other energy carriers, scarce resources. And I've mentioned the water example. LPG availability in 2008, when we had the load shedding in Cape Town, one of the programs that were run is everyone was given a free two-plate gas stove to stop cooking with electricity. So people just had to bring in their electric stove and they got a free LPG gas stove. What happened is, because the load shedding, the refineries were also affected, we ran out of LPG gas. So all we've done is moved the problem from the electricity sector to the gas sector, because people after a few weeks said, well, we can't get gas anywhere. At least with the load shedding, we had 4 hours of electricity a day, we could cook a meal. Now there's no gas at all. So we just changed the problem. So Eskom said, okay, well, we've saved now, we've kept the lights working. But what has happened to the person at the end of the value chain, and what has happened to the LPG gas industry now seems to be these pariahs that can't deliver and not contributing. So we have to understand these moves in the market and not just focus on specifically the one sector. So it does not reflect the bigger picture of transparent growth. I do say that these contracts where we're giving away this 5.4 billion rand is rights and is responsibility. The person has the right to claim money to implement an energy efficient project, but the responsibility of the person has to achieve those savings. Otherwise, you're just improving their profitability, their bottom line, and they're not getting the savings. So there are contracts in place, but not one since the implementation of demand side management is one has to be the penalties being imposed for not achieving the savings, and there are lots of these projects that haven't achieved these savings. And why? It's customer service. You know, for Eskom to go and take one of their own customers to court for something that's not electricity related, it's not related to the bill, is probably going to be contradictory to their actual aim of being more customer friendly. So the risk, chair, members of the committee, is that national planning can become very difficult and it can be impacted and it can be 100% off the mark if we're basing our planning on the figures that we are using. Because energy efficiency, if you look at the IRP and the IEP, energy efficiency is a resource, as is the power station. It's regarded as a megawatt power station. It's built into the plan. If we don't achieve these certain savings in energy, it's as good as us not building Fusilli or Madupi on time. So if we're using the figures that are currently there, we could be 100% off the mark, because we're not looking at a consolidated picture. Ratepayers are going to question the value in the MIPD3 saving. The strength is 5.4 billion. What is the true picture? What value do we as customers get as a result of that funding through the tariff? And as I said, if we look globally, and when we report to the International Energy Agency and other multilateral agencies, we cannot provide a true reflection on the progress that South Africa is making in terms of energy efficiency in this area. So we're also missing an opportunity, and I have already spoken, to create a significant number of new jobs in the area of measurement and verification by opening it up to a broader sector of the market. So from our side, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, a proposed solution using an example would be that we need to consolidate measurement and verification of energy efficiency, all energy efficiency initiatives, into one common portal with a central repository of auditable and value-adding data. The data, if I say value-adding, should be built back into the planning process, should be auditable by any party, it should be able to be interrogated by the public, by any auditor, the Auditor General, anyone that wants to have a look at figures, which is not the case right now. It should be a one-stop shop. All electrical energy and demand savings should be incorporated in this database. Fuel switching impacts should be there, so if you're moving from electricity to LPG, that's not necessarily being energy efficient. It's being electrical efficient, but it might be becoming LPG inefficient. And we need to look at those impacts, those sectoral moves and fuel switching. We need to look at the economics of this. There are economic impacts that are broader than just electricity. And your Honourable Chair mentioned that this morning in your introduction, that this is affecting everyday lives, and we need to be able to track that in a transparent and a meaningful way. And we need to track jobs created. We know we have an energy crisis and we have a high unemployment rate. We need to be able to provide appropriate training, capacity building in the areas that need it, and we need to be able to measure and report on that in relation to the megawatts that we are saving or the joules that we are saving if we look at the energy future. So the example is the energy efficiency tax incentive. This is a tax incentive offered by Treasury. They say, we offering the tax incentive. We don't want to be involved in the measurement and verification. The 12R and 12L tax incentives. So they've asked Sonedi as an independent agent reporting to government that has got a group of energy experts working in all sectors of the market to do the measurement and verification and provide the assurance function to SARS that when SARS actually pays the person a rebate, that they know that those savings have been done. But Treasury say, we don't want to be involved in that. That's not our business. And Sonedi is doing that on their door. AFD is the French Development Bank. They've offered a green credit line to key commercial banks where you can get a very good loan on very good terms if you're implementing energy efficiency. It is 2% below prime. You have the first 2 years, you don't have to pay anything back, so you have a window of opportunity to build up the savings, and then you have a 10-year repayment option. So this is with EBSA Bank, Nedbank, and the IDC is also getting some of the funding. Once again, they say the banks, your business is banking, not energy. So they've asked us to provide their technical assistance facility, and to do, they will do the risk analysis in terms of the affordability and ability to pay back, and all the financial impact. But they've also needed to provide that measurement and verification function to make sure that this is independent and that the savings are adhered to. And the same applies for the Department of Public Works. In that particular role, we are also providing the measurement and verification function going forward. So, Honourable Chair, in conclusion, my request is that we need feedback on whether a proposal to have a consolidated measurement and verification basis or database for all energy efficiency implementation is feasible, and if so, we would like to do a detailed feasibility study and develop an action plan to move towards a transition where all energy efficiency projects are reported into the single portal. I think the enabling legislation through the regulations provided by the Department of Energy in terms of the requirements to provide energy-related data are in place, so that can be invoked if you have one central repository. The Portfolio Committee's assistance in lobbying this approach with other stakeholders would also be critically important if this was seen as something that should be taken forward. It's something that is in the mandate from the Department of Energy through the Energy Act for Sonedi to do, but we have to be real, we have to be honest, Chair, is that we're dealing with different line functions of government. Eskom reports to the Department of Public Enterprises, we have the Department of Environment, the MRV function, we have environment impacts, we have the Department of Energy, and it's a cross-government or intergovernmental role that needs to be played in lobbying everyone that we do this in the national interest, not specifically for one particular line function. With that, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to thank you for your indulgence in listening to me.
Thank you very much, Mr. Brandt. How I wish you could have also written your last point, the emphasis on intergovernmental collaboration or intergovernmental collaboration, but so members have taken note of that. Shall we move to the next presentation? CVW. Honourable Chair, Honourable Members and Members of the Public, thank you very much for being here today and enlightening you on our progress that we've been doing in the Southern Cape Karoo municipalities, where energy efficiency is quite close to our heart. Mr. Kevin Grunewald unfortunately couldn't make it, but we've asked the services of Mr. Landile Shembe to do the presentation with us. First of all, we are going to look at renewable energy, the George Way. Then we are going to look at Eskom, the effect of energy efficiency and demand side management. In the same region where we are active, the city energy support unit's role. Mr. Andrew Janish has done that, but we will just give the clarity of what they've been doing. implementation of energy efficiency that will be done by myself, comparison of graphs for the 5 municipalities. The 5 municipalities that are involved is George Municipality, Mosselbay Municipality, Bitter Municipality, Kanaland Municipality, and Esseplan Municipality. Then just the 2009-2010 up to 2011-2012, the lessons learned. And then if you're looking at the Division of Revenue Act, are stating as far as energy efficiency and demand side management, that new proposals could be launched by the 3rd of September. And then the conclusion to this. George Municipality have made the statement that they would like to be self-sufficient regarding energy by 2030. It is a tall order, but I think that is what we are all working together to ensure that we are having security of energy, and more specifically, like Barry would like to call it, security about electricity energy. There's a biomass plant that the Central Energy Fund and Environmental Carbon Options was involved at George. That is a project that we would like to see that it must progress further. We are in talks with Eskom at the Eskom Test and Demonstration Center at Blanco to put up a 500 kilowatt IPP plant. We are looking at biogas energy at the Gwang wastewater treatment plant, and then also a solar energy facility at Gwang of 5 megawatt. And then there are various energy agreements in place with Eskom, the Rebit, and other IPPs in the same area of up to 10 megawatt. Energy efficiency measures is being dealt with at all the George municipality centres. And this is just a tongue-in-the-cheek slide. We all know REITS was prevalent, and I know the portfolio committee was having presentations on that around about two months ago. But yes, in the Southern Cape Karoo, if we are looking at shareholding in such a big REIT, you are in the order of 2%. Whereas in the Southern Cape Karoo, we are now called the city. Okay, the Eskom energy efficiency and demand side management will be dealt.
Where did you get that picture?
Mr. Chairman, it was a self-made picture. But it is just telling you that if you're looking at a regional electricity distributor of 1 million customers, and in an area so remotely as far as the Southern Cape Karoo, we are in the order of 250,000 customers. So if you're looking at the total shareholding in such a venture, it is less than 3%. So it is just if you've been looking at the shareholding in REIT 1, which the Southern Cape Crew would have been part of, the city of Cape Town was in the order of 44%. Eskom in that same area was around about 43%, and the rest has been made up of the other municipalities. So it was just a tongue in the cheek. We have done this at Witsand at the AMEU, where Mrs. Lorena Redlinger is of Eskom. So Eskom have various interventions at this stage at energy efficiency and demand side management that we are participating in, but I'm not going to deal with that any further. This was the time in 2006 where the so-called Western Cape problem started off with the two units that was out at Kuba, and that we were having load shedding in those years, and it was actually the start that we have done in the Southern Cape Karoo to look at energy efficiency and demand side management systems. There's also a body called the City Energy Support Group that are being funded by the British government here in South Africa that are doing very, very good work as well. We have made use of them in 2007-2008 to come up with a spreadsheet to see what interventions can be done at municipal level. and we will share that with you at a later stage. Okay, the implementation of energy efficiency, the city way. We have in 2008, when the electricity crisis had become a national crisis, we have done a applications to the Department of Energy. At that stage, it was still done at ESCOM. And these five municipalities have been really privileged to have received funding for the past 2 years from the Department of Energy for energy efficiency and demand side management initiatives. And we would like to take this moment to also thank the Department of Energy for the sterling work that they are doing. Unless we are doing anything, we are going to be a little eyes looking at the screen and seeing why are we here. So what we are talking 2008, we have provided the Department of Energy with business plans for the past 3 years, and the new business plans have to be in with the department by the 3rd of September, which we have done, and hopefully we can continue doing the good work. During our planning meeting on the 9th of June, the technology that we have started off was new street lighting, retrofit street lighting, retrofit LED traffic signals, new LED traffic signals, smart meters, public building retrofits, pumping efficiency, and then other. And we have felt very strongly about that energy efficiency is one part of the equation. But to be really successful, you must look at generation of renewable energy within a municipality as well. So yes, we've been looking at wave farms, we've been looking at wind farms, electricity from waste, and electricity from sewage. These are the funding patterns that we were receiving from the Department of Energy. And the mission of the Department of Energy Energy Efficiency Directorate is to develop measures to promote energy saving, reduce the negative impact of energy use on the environment, reduce energy costs to the economy, contribute towards sustainable development, and to achieve a national energy policy. So yes, and we will look into the ESCOM grid, the load profile of Proteus, monthly, weekly, and then the profiles of the five participating municipalities. We are not going to deal with each in depth. We are going to look at your municipality more and more in depth. So if one is looking at the ESCOM grid, one is seeing Proteus just left of George down at Mosselbay, and Proteus is a 400 to 132 kV substation with a really peaky maximum demand. So myself and Carden have discussed it there that if you can do this on a MTS substation basis, you can save nearly 100 megawatt down in the case of one MTS substation. If you are just cutting off the peaks, you are looking in the order of 50 megawatts. So yes, I think there's huge room for maximum demand and energy efficiency measures if you are looking at the bigger picture or at the ESCOM level.
First one, engineers. You're not speaking to the engineer. Can you repeat the last slide slowly and just be mindful that you're speaking to non-technical people.
Thank you.
It seems to be very, very important. So that's why I'm asking you humbly.
No problem.
Maybe take us through, and I'm looking at the ESCOM engineers, so that if you're out of line, tell me to my rescue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I think if we can categorize the country, and especially where we are sitting in the Western Cape, we are talking about the total load from south of Hydra. So Hydra is roundabout at the arc. You are talking the total load downwards. We are talking about around about 5,200 megawatts. which must be transported by transmission lines. Those transmission lines are from Hydra. There are three that is coming into Drore Field at Wilford West, and two are coming straight down to the Cape. At Drore Field, there is one 400 kV line that can transport in the order of 600 megawatt that is coming down to Proteus, which is at Mosselbay. And then from Proteus, you go back. From Proteus, so if you're looking there, the R is the what we call the so-called Cape Load, downwards, to Beaufort West, down to George, down to the Cape, via Vredendal, back to the Cape. So those are...
So that is the other numbers, I'm sure you can see it here next to the number 16. Because you must have a visual picture, because we're saying anything below geographically, DR. Okay.
Yeah. So it is just south of the R. That is what we call the Cape Load. Okay. So if we are looking at each and every main transmission system, so at the R there is a main transmission system. At Beaufort West there's a main transmission system. At Mosselbay there's one. There's one at Worcester. And then you've got two big ones within the Cape Metropole. Then you've got Kuberg, which can inject 2 by 900 megawatt of electricity into that same grid. You are having also permit pumping storage, which are just on the top of the mountain down to Krabbo. So what we are trying to say, the total Cape load is 5,200 megawatts. The load at Proteus, if you are going to the next slide, the load at Proteus is, so it is all the towns and all the Eskom networks that are being fed from Proteus at Mosselbay. So that is the total graph of all the loads. And what we can see in this graph, that it is a very peaky graph. Now, it is those peaks that you try to move into the valleys. So if you're looking on a weekly profile, that You can look at round about 180.
Sorry. This one is the weekly profile.
Okay.
Compared to the monthly profile.
That's correct, yes. So it's the same profile. I've just enlarged 1 week of that. So it is just important to say that our total base load before any cyclic variation is round about 180 megawatts. Then if you are taking the average, you will be running at 320 megawatt. And what we are trying to say, we must try and develop through energy efficiency and demand side management a mechanism that we can smooth that graph so that we don't have to run expensive peaking plant like the Atlantis one, like the Gorikwa one, to make up for these peaks when they arrive. Okay, so I think the main reason, and there are various ways, there are load management that we are doing by cutting off the geyser within the household. So George Municipality are having 13,000 load control relays that they are already shifting. The problem is, we as municipalities are doing it on our own and to the best benefit of the municipality. So whereas we should actually look at the total load at Proteus and do our control accordingly, according to that graph. So we could have the situation that the peak at Proteus is happening at 7 o'clock at evening, the actual peak at George can happen at 8 o'clock in the evening. And we are cutting the peak according to the George profile, but we are getting a new peak at Curtius at 7 o'clock. So that is the point that I'm trying to say, is that there are various energy efficiency and demand side measures that we can take forward into smoothing that graph. The solutions to that is I think we must accept that, especially in the Southern Cape Karoo, around about 50% of our load is coming from residential customers, and not so much from industry. So one can there are basically two ways to solve that: is to put in a more aggressive demand side management system in place through geyser load management, as well as putting in a time of use tariff on domestic customers to ensure, to penalize the people to shift load from the peak period into the off-peak period. Okay, this is Mossovan municipality. It is just telling you that residential middle income, residential low income, we are also in the order of 50% of the total load. In the case of George municipality, it is exactly the same. So the residential mid income and the residential low income is in the order of 50% of the total load. So during the period of 2009 to 10 to 2011 to 12, George municipality have proven beyond reasonable doubt that energy efficiency combined with load management and future renewable energy generation is the best way to solve the power shortages in South Africa in the short to medium term. The average maximum demand has decreased from 78 megawatts in 2008 to 70 megawatts in 2012. So that was a saving of 8 megawatts. Now 8 megawatts, if you would like to put that into context, I don't know if you know the town of Riversdal. The town of Riversdal has a maximum demand of 8 megawatts. So George municipality have saved in 4 to 5 years. They have saved the electricity to a town like Riversdal. The total energy usage has decreased from 468 to 09 megawatt hours in 2008 to 428,433, which is the 38,000 megawatt saving.
Honorable Chair, you said some of you are coming from Gauteng, and maybe some honorable members would not be aware of where Riversdal is and the size thereof. I would like to liken it to Harrismith. That's the size of possible rivers outside.
This is just the a summation of the electricity account from George municipality to Eskom, and it is just showing you that as far as maximum demand, they have saved 10%, 9.37%, and as far as total energy is concerned, they have saved 8.28%, which is a 7.318 megawatt and 38,000 kilowatt hours in that same period. But what is also now, if we are talking about peak standard and off-peak, that is the tariff that Eskom is selling electricity to its municipalities and to the bulk industrial users. So if we are comparing, and what we are asking is that peak period is between 7 and 10 and in the morning, and at night between 6 and 9. What we are trying to achieve in the long run is to move as a lot of electricity from the standard to the off-peak period, and a lot of from the peak into the standard. That is the only way that you will be able to smooth that graph that you've been seeing. So Africa still have a winter peak of 2,000 megawatts and a summer peak of 1,000 megawatts that can be saved from the national demand of 37,500 megawatts in winter and 32,000 megawatts in summer. So if one is comparing these graphs from a national level down to a local level, this is what you're looking at. The winter load profile is still very peaky. Peak demand exists for only a few hours per day, but Eskom have to have enough capacity in the system to meet that demand. George Municipality, we believe, and the other municipalities have proved to the Department of Energy, and we can just, as far as what Barry was saying, is totally true. So far, we've been told to make use of one of the seven universities, and in the case of these five municipalities, we've made use of the Cape Peninsula University of Technology in Cape Town, and Mr. Wolfert Fritzi have done the measurement and verification. But it is important that somebody independently will come and do this measurement and verification process. So according to the DORA new applications, we have launched the follow applications by the 3rd of September, and we hope that we can go on by trying to keep the lights on. Energy efficiency, in closing arguments, Mr. Chairman, energy efficiency is the cheapest way to defer the building of power stations. With embedded renewable generation, even more savings can be realized. Local municipalities is the best service delivery mechanism for energy efficiency and renewable generation because it is much easier measurable on your electricity bill. Every local municipality must have at least 5 megawatts of renewable generation, either from solar, wind, or biomass. I thank you in conclusion, Mr.
Trust me, your problem, I share your sentiment. I spend a lot of time with my learned friend, Mr. Carlo van Beek, and I have to ask him four times to repeat himself slowly because I'm not as technical as he is. He's well experienced. He had over 40 years, starting from the railways and coming all the way via Eskom and helping the Western Cape municipalities in ways that he does. But I'd like to sum up the non-technical version of what he said. The municipalities, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members, in the Southern Cape have proven beyond a shadow of a doubt that if they are allowed the space. Well, firstly, we want to thank you for the funding that has made this possible. But if they are allowed the space to lead their own energy efficiency programs and allow the space to venture into places where Sanedi would bury behind me would actually encourage us to do, you can make a saving that is actually the one that he mentioned, the 8 megawatt with the one example like equal to Riversdale. Such savings, as much as Sanedi will say we cannot quantify it to the last megawatt, however, can be put in a region that is plausible. Now, looking at the solutions, we can talk about meters. We can talk about solar, wind. We can solar and wind and biomass. But we find that municipalities are their arms or their hands are actually tied, because either then the funding that comes from the Department of Energy, there is no support or protection from my friends right at the back who are now looking at me, Eskom. To say, but listen, you are a buyer of electricity and this is what the Act says and this is what the contracts will say and this is as far as we are willing to talk to you. So So we are pleading with the committee to say, can we put forward some of the proposals and make examples of things that we've already achieved that might be valuable information for the committee to see how that can be implemented elsewhere. I thank you.
Just by constitution, if we don't do anything, we will have blackness and darkness around us with the full Eskom collapsing. Welcome to the Southern Cape.
Bye, thank you, Minister. I almost said of the three bouncing. But the honourable members of the will agree with me. These two presentations should be converted to full documents, not just power presentations. Because a good example is that the Jordan municipality is making reference to lack of protection and what they would like to do. And if it's done verbally, it's not going to be easy to capture that because there's a lot behind it. And the extent to which you would like to see municipalities doing things on their own. And remember, this prompts me to say we need to, myself and the community secretary, to do our level best to ensure that SALGA is here, even if they just do an oral presentation, because this is just one municipality. But you must also have a global picture that what are the other municipalities either doing or not doing. It's not just about the good things, but it's about where are the gaps? Because if one set of municipalities can do such, you know, it means it gives us, you know, some model as to what we can ensure could be done. Us as the National Assembly, together with the NCOP and together with the SALGA itself as the umbrella body. You know. Otherwise, thanks very much. Let's move to. I'm sure you. You'll help me with the pronunciation. Thank you, General. Will you enrique yourself as well, please?
Honorable Chair, honorable members, members of the public, you will see on the agenda, Honorable Chair, that Ms. Lisa Reynolds was supposed to present this morning. She unfortunately had to fly to the UK on Monday. And I say it's a pity because we heard earlier Barry saying that energy efficiency and the 10400 building code has come for the last 10 years. And in fact, she was one of the members that sat with that for the last 10 years. She has an intimate knowledge of what we're going to be looking at. But we will try. My name is Bruce Murray. I have my colleague Sam Kerr next to me. And we will take you through a presentation of Sangaban Construction Products. To start off with, we will look at...
I missed the other gentleman's name.
Sean Gerber. We'll go through briefly the company, Sangaban, the government, the NBR, and the research, a proposal, example of interventions, other advantages, and a conclusion. If we look at Sangaban as an organization, our chairman and CEO, Pierre-André de Chalendar, has recently stated that our challenge is to save energy and protect the environment by aiding in the creation of healthy buildings that are comfortable to live in. This significant opportunity comes with an obligation to be above reproach in the way that we conduct our business. Sustainability is at the core of Sangaban's habitat and construction strategy. If we just have a look at the business, Honourable Chair, we have five divisions. We have our Gyproc division, which is Sangaban's gypsum activity, supplier of complete gypsum-based product range. We have ISAVA, who is Sangaban's insulation activity. Local operations include glass wool, mineral wool, and expanded polystyrene. We have Weber, Saint-Gobain's mortars activity, manufacturing tile adhesive and grout, wall and floor coatings, Marbleite and other swimming pool coatings, and an external insulation system for new and retrofitted buildings. We have the pipelines, PAM, manufacture cast iron products for the building and civil construction industry. It has the distinction that it manufactures a complete range of manhole covers and frames, stormwater gratings, and of course our iconic three-legged poikie. We have Norton Saint-Gobain Abrasives, manufacturer and supplier of performance engineered abrasives for technical and commercial applications, as well as general household and automotive refinishing solutions. That, in brief, is the company. If we go on to national energy, efficiency standards and regulations. The energy efficiency standard for buildings, which is SANS 204, was published in October in 2008, with a second publication in July 2011. The National Building Regulation for Sustainability is Part X, and for Energy Efficiency is XA. This was gazetted in September 2011, promulgated in November 2011, and it is applicable to new plans and renovations needing plan approval. The deemed to satisfy the XA SANS 10400 XA was based on SANS 204 with slightly less stringent requirement, and the deemed to satisfy is what is in law today. It was published in July 2011, and requirements will be increased over the next 3 to 5 years. This was where the Honourable Minister signed a new regulation in. The Department of Energy research report stated that before any building standard can be made mandatory, it has to be demonstrated that it will not be inflationary. Department of Energy commissioned a report to investigate if the intervention of SANS 204 complied with this criterion. And of course it demonstrated that it had a positive life cycle cost. In other words, interventions have a payback less than the lifespan of the building. Payback worked out much shorter than this in actual fact. It obviously depends on a number of factors. Insulated ceilings and walls are an energy efficiency intervention with relatively short payback periods. If we have a look at the building envelope, Honourable Chair, you can see that through the roof we lose 35% of the energy. Through the glazing 10% and through the walls 25%. So the whole idea of insulation is to keep the heat in, to allow the heat in, and to keep the cold out, the principle of insulation. So correctly insulating a building envelope in combination with energy saving techniques can control energy losses and reduce energy consumption by up to 78%. What does the NBR XA Part XA mean in terms of energy saving? Applicable to new plans and renovations needing plan approval. So new buildings and renovation sections will show energy savings and increased comfort. Proportion of new buildings to existing building stock, of course, is low. And with the current economic climate, the number of new houses being built is far less compared to the existing stock that we have. So a proposal, and this is in our submission, how can we redress this? A retrofitting program for existing buildings. Insulation and ceiling interventions, performance parameters according to SANS 204. Many countries have programs such as this, where energy savings are used to fund or partially fund programs. We need to assist the Department of Energy in their strategy of achieving energy savings in buildings, in residential, commercial, and other. Interventions, possible interventions, low-cost, affordable, government-subsidized housings do not have ceilings. There is no insulation in the roof or ceilings. Many buildings do not have ceiling or roofing insulation. most buildings do not have insulated walls. These interventions can be retrofitted generally easily, depending on the design of the building. Energy saving and better comfort would result. Retrofitting program should be applicable to the same types of buildings that have to comply with XA. People, personal occupied buildings where driving need for energy is people comfort, heating, cooling, and ventilation. Residential, commercial, offices, schools, clinics, hospitals, hotels, hostels, shops, and shopping centers. Examples of interventions, you just have a look at a couple of the drawings there, you can see the ceiling insulation, the shopping center factory roof insulation at the bottom. To the right hand side we have flat concrete roofs that can be insulated. Buildings such as, I'm sure, the one we are sitting in, right at the top will be a flat concrete roof where a lot of energy is being lost. Other solutions in walls, with on the right hand side we can see a dry lining, and in the bottom we can see an ETIX. ETIX is external thermal insulation. Just a few examples on the bottom left, the lightweight steel frame with insulation in the walls. R value required for zone 1 in the climatic zone would be 2.2 R value. That is, of course, subject to the thickness of the intervention insulation. Other advantages, health, Nedlac report, 2.3 billion spent on healthcare due to respiratory diseases caused by poor indoor quality from the burning of wood, paraffin, and other fossil fuels for heat and for cooking. Increased energy efficiency, better comfort equals decreased driver for burning fossil fuels and better health and decreased health costs. Job creation in countries with similar programs, it has been measured that jobs created by retrofitting programs are more than those created by generating energy. Skilled and semi-skilled jobs, labor from communities implementing programs, training on-site, facilities such as those at Saint-Gobain or others. New training programs with new opportunities for employment. In conclusion, we say that new building regulation will go some way to achieving energy savings in building stock. But to really achieve these goals, we need to consider a retrofitting of existing building stock. Ceilings and insulation have a good payback, ideal retrofitting intervention. This program can create jobs. Improved occupant health will also result.
Honourable Chair, thank you. That is what we have. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you very much. Same colleague now, please. Mr. Murray, I'm calling you correctly.
Yes.
This is quite stunning, just one company. Now I have to hand over to members to ask, but if I can just shoot the first one, question. Is your company part of some building association? And to what extent have does your recommendations and the proposal get support from whatever association that your company belongs to?
Honourable Chair, we are part of the Thermal Insulation Association of South Africa, and I think certainly the sentiments expressed in this presentation are shared by all the members throughout the industry of insulation manufacturers.
Honourable members, sorry for breaking the tradition. No kind of comment to start the question, but I was just, it seems to still extend of such a performance, to the nation just by one company among the men. Mama Tivela, followed by Ndate Lucas, Honorable Frailing, Mintindo, Kona. Oh, Kunga.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for the wonderful presentation. I'm very much interested in the last one. I just want to know in the houses, the old houses which are there, is it expensive to do what you're talking about, to do that, to keep the house warm in winter and cool in summer? I'm asking this because I've got a house that was very dark, and a glass was put right around the which is bringing in light. Is that what you are talking about or what? Thank you.
Yes, I think we all on the same page, and we all have the same, we're driven by the same initiative that we want to save. And what is a bit of concern? We have something like, maybe completely out of line, but we have so much daylight in our country, and we have the difference between the East and the West Coast. I don't see anyone looking at the peak saving up. Isn't this the possibility that we can utilize that? At least of our difference, while we have our peak hour in Joburg at 1 o'clock, we could have the peak hour in Cape Town at 2 o'clock, and that would sort of balance off the demand. But it's just my thinking, and I think might be the answer to that, whether it's possible. The other thing is this insulation, where they say we keeping the heat in and the cold out. What happens in summer? Because it'd be interesting to know, because that is, and then to the George Municipality House, job well done, but can't we spread this? This is what it is. You know, we're not isolated, because this is a national problem. We need not to just do it in a little town, whereas it's much easier to measure it in George. How would it be actually? Thank you.
What's the following
thanks, Jay. Now, I just want to know from Mr. Kobe, the his energy saving thing. The houses that are being built now, why are they not included or paid? Is your company still a new company? Because I saw last night that houses that were being given to people handed out by the president that have no electricity at all. And I just wondered to myself, you know, most people in South Africa are still reliant on electricity for heating and for energy as well. Now, if houses don't have electricity, it means those people are going to suffer for the rest of their lives, because some are old people that can be employed, and, you know, it means that people are going to suffer. Now, this company, no, I don't want to ask that question.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair, and let me just first apologize for coming late as well, so I think I missed the first presentation. But, I mean, the two ones that I have heard are very interesting and poses a number of questions for me. Just in terms, let me deal with the George Municipality first. And I want to drill a bit deeper into your presentation. And because one of the big disincentives for energy efficiency in municipalities is that a lot of municipalities get most of their revenue from electricity sales. What is the situation in George? What percentage of your revenue for your municipality comes from electricity sales? And has that acted as any kind of disincentive around energy efficiency? And what is your proposals going forward? Because I know in the city of Cape Town, for instance, I mean, there's a major problem, there's a major threat to their revenue base. Is it the same situation in George as well? So when you consider things such as people putting solar panels on their roof and selling energy back to the grid, does this represent a major threat to your revenue base, or is this something that you would be looking at pushing ahead on? Then just in terms of time of use, I mean, I think time of use is the kind of Gordian knot that we really need to break within municipalities. And I'd be interested, I know in Cape Town, for instance, there's, I think, about 26 different tariffs that they get charged by Eskom depending on the time of the week and the time of the day that they do that. Yet they charge a single tariff to residential customers. And that obviously poses a huge problem. Is it the same situation in George? And would you then be in favor of a rollout of time-of-use meters that we could push in terms of domestic? Do you think that should be a priority of us so that we can actually start to charge the differential tariffs? Then just in terms of Saint Gobain, I think that's how you pronounce it there. Yeah, I mean, very interesting presentation. We actually did a tour, the Energy Committee, to the Kiasa project in Cape Town, where they started to also, one of the interventions was to put in ceiling. And they found that did bring about huge energy savings in the long run. So they are motivating at this point that it's been included in the DORA fund, so that municipalities can in fact put in, have a ceiling rollout program to look at that. What is the cost at the moment of putting the ceiling in? I mean, how much funds are we looking at, and what kinds of energy savings do you think that would transpire from that? Just to kind of see how much value for money we would get from a kind of ceiling program. But I think it could make a very good working for energy program if you hire teams of people to go out and retrofit RDP houses with ceilings. That certainly could do that. And then in terms of the new building regulations around new buildings have to have, I know one of the interventions is solar water heaters, have to get 50% of their hot water from a renewable energy source. But a complaint that I keep hearing is that most people out there, most builders and developers, don't even know about this regulation, and it certainly isn't being enforced at this stage. What is your sense around these building regulations? Do you think we need far greater enforcement? Do we need far greater education in the marketplace? Just to give us a sense of what's going on out there, because I think we really need to know that.
Thank you, Chair. The question that I wanted to ask was around the church municipality. I got lost about the issue, but it's fine. Because some of the other issues, as the chairperson was saying, we're too technical about them. And I try to match myself with it, but what I wanted to understand, probably it's one of the questions that Helen was just speaking about, the issue of the tariffs, and probably the looking at the aspect that we are speaking in terms of the South Coast. What is your view in terms of the, you know, the upper side and the north side? What would be the difference between the two? Because your proposal was to say you bring this proposal here, and you are now being the portfolio committee to, you know, take this thing as a pilot to the whole country. What is your the difference between, you know, the South Coast and the north side? Because obviously the tariffs won't be the same. One, two, with the aspect that transmission lines on the other side, no, the distance is too long. So if you can be able to also clarify me around that. The other aspect relates to the same campaign, this English way. Well, the aspect is that, well, this sounds very much interesting. But I'm trying to understand your houses, how do they differ with the ones that I think they are built somewhere in Kailich, if I'm not mistaken, where we went here for oversight. The house that they said they facing north, then Atlantis here. How do they differ from those houses where their energy source, they get it from the sun most cases, and you know every time when the sun goes, it still get the heat, and then the later side obviously has got the ceiling. But yours is that the insulation is all over the houses, including in terms of the walls. I'm trying to check the difference between the two houses, and obviously one of the questions that is asked by one of the other members, that what happens in terms of, you know, in summer. Because I'm trying to look at this aspect, because my understanding is that probably you built these structures in the aspect of probably, are you located here in Western Cape? Or are you located here in Western Cape, or are you national? Because that's what I want to try to understand, because when you look at these building aspects, it suits the environment and the weather of Cape Town, they say. But when you look, go down to Limpopo, way more water, you know, what is going to happen? Because that, those are the aspects that one might be able to change. Maybe to ask the other question related to the salary. You spoke about the energy efficient tax incentives. If you can just a little bit clarify better there, because I'm trying to understand that the tax incentives, where would they come from the consumers or from government? Who will subsidize that tax incentives? If you can be able to clarify me there, because I need to get understand. The other thing that you spoke about, you said there are three commercial banks that fund what the project. Okay. I'm trying to understand those projects, that whether would they be able to assist young people, because my concern is that when these three commercial banks going to assist probably young companies, what are they going to consider? Because my fear is that you know, all these institutions, they come being established to come and assist poor people from South Africa, but at the same time they are given this funding to assist, but you'll find them resisting in terms of assisting, because they want you to come with a backup finance or whatsoever, instead of, you know, trying to assist and give and develop those young companies. That's one of my other concerns. Thank you, Chair.
Prof. Kandubona, Honorable Smala, and any other hands? Okay. Prof. and Honorable Smala.
Thank you, Chair. I'll start with Sonedi. And it's so. Unfortunately, your slides don't have numbers. The one that deals with current situation. You say, among others, your last comment, they say it's M&B function to ensure that these targets are indeed achieved. Currently, RAI resides within ESCO, and this is surely a conflict of interest. I want to lift that so that if you are putting to us, so that we need to engage it, we know exactly what you mean. How would we take that forward? Again, when you talked about solar system, you said you not everybody's counted in, because you just jumped in and did what you did in your own house. That again talked to me. I didn't even go to those that were under ESCOM. But I'm constantly asking a question about this last system. To me, in my own house, it looks like a schism. When it is summer, I use hot water. When it is winter, I need to go back to my electricity. Is that what this is? Again, you referred to the double windows, glazed. I was pleasant surprised when I visited Germany sometime, a long time ago. I don't know when. But what I thought they were, when you talk about windows, most offices have more windows than solid. The end of that, there's no need for you to switch your lights on when you come in. Is this the kind of thing that is in these regulations that we're dealing with here? Are we saying you need to have fewer windows, but double something? The last question, it relates to what is happening again when you go out abroad. For that, when you go into that hotel room, once you take that card off, everything is off. When you come in, only you are forced to switch. If I was coming off as here, have our office light on as well today. Chances are our lights are off. Is that system
except mine?
Is that system too expensive? Why is that you are not considering something like that here in South Africa? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. My question to the George municipality is the target to be self-sufficient by 2013. The consideration of your energy mix, how does that focus within your planning? Because I looked at the proposals that was on your slide, and it is cleaner energy mixes, but and we do know that that is usually cost of, you know, it's more expensive than the conventional energy mix. And how would you subsidize then that, or is that arrangement going with selling that back into ESCOM? Because if and I would like you to speak in the context of maybe IPPs and where we might be going, and taking those things into consideration. Also, maybe your frustrations into funding your business plans. I do note that you know, there's only so much money available, especially from the department and from the national treasury. So it's not a program that can be really fully rolled out to all 280 odd municipalities. But I know that complying to the various regulations is not a overnight situation, and reporting on those funding in order to making sure of it. Does your is the funding that is being offered to your various municipalities, the rollout of those business plans and the changing of your infrastructure system in order to save, will it at the end result be that you will be able to roll out your full business plan to complete it eventually, or will you be stuck with a situation where you only completed maybe say 30% or 50% of those? I just would like to understand those agreements and maybe your possible risk in not fully getting that through. I'm just going to stop there for now. The others will answer questions like that.
We'll start with sensitive numbers on the file report, but the others will follow suit as well.
Morning, Honourable Chair. Morning, members. Morning, ladies and gentlemen. To the lady's first question over there, I do apologise not remembering your name. With regarding to the cost of insulation and how it would work under a glass, if you should have a glass roofing structure and heat coming through there. The legislation, the new building code 10400XA, stipulates that you can't first of all have more than 15% of fenestration of glass in a 100 square meter area, for argument's sake. So you've got 100 square meters, 15 square meters of that, and more should you go that way, it would have to be double glazing, as Barry mentioned earlier. However, if it's less, and you've got sun coming through there, in your summer months, it's going to create a lot of heat inside that house. So you need to control that to a point by either having your windows open. My point being behind that is there's an education element that comes into to thermal insulation on how it gets used. So it's not an on-off button. It's a bottom line is in the mornings, on a summer day, for example, the sun's baking down. So that morning you let air circulate throughout that house. So you've got fresh air inside the house. Then you've got to manage that house correctly in the sense of either curtains, preferably reflective blinds, some have to reflect that sun. Then you mentioned also is a cost factor, which is an important one.
Thank you, but not the whole, it's not the roof, the whole roof. It's just a small piece, a round piece of glass, which brings in light. That's what I'm asking. Is it the same thing?
I understood that. The skylight, there's benefits and negatives to the skylight factor because you allow immense heat into the house through a skylight. The benefits are in winter, that'll be lovely, it's fantastic. But come the summer months, you're going to have that hot heat penetrating through a skylight. Now, if you've got thermal insulation in the house, that hot heat is not going to be able to, the heat's going to come up and try and get out of the house. That's the reality of heat, especially in the Cape region where we have an upward scenario. So the heat's not going to be able to leave the house. So a skylight for me in the Cape, it's not exactly the best way to go about things if you haven't got other forms of air movement in that house, i.e. aircon, fans. So it's not a good idea. That's the reality of skylights. The other gentleman asked about what happens in summer as opposed to winter. Sorry, the gentleman in front of me here. Summer is once again it's management of thermal insulation. In the summer months, what would happen is opposed to your winter months, you would once again, in the morning, wake up on a Saturday morning, for argument's sake, you would open up your windows and doors and let the air circulate throughout that house, regardless of the size of the house. By then, you're displacing that old air with nice, good, fresh air, hopefully. Then, around 10:30 or so, before that sun is at its peak, you would possibly close the doors, close the blinds, curtains, control and to manage that air so it stays cool. Because you've got that cool air inside the house, you have thermal insulation in the ceiling. Now thermal is a term which people are using in the industry called R values, which is thermal resistance. Now that resists the sun. And the higher your thermal resistance, the more cooler your house will be. So if you have a thermal resistance of, in the Cape, the new legislation says 3.7, then you're going to have a lot less hot air coming into the house and a lot less cool air leaving the house in summer months. So your house should be a lot cooler if it's managed correctly. You also mentioned about the Western Cape and or the Cape at least with our weather conditions in the Cape. Now this legislation that's come out, 10400XA, is a national legislation and is divided into climatic zones 1 to 6. What that does is it says to you identifies what type of climatic zone you're in. So in the Western Cape, for example, in the Cape, we say we've got to achieve an R value of 3.7. Now an R value, once again, is what R value is required for that environment of energy. So what will happen is you move to Durban, for argument's sake, it'll be a different R value required in Durban. So every region will have its own climatic zone and how it's linked and how it's dealt with in its zone. One needs to also recall, Honourable Chair, that from a thermal aspect, and it was partly in our slides as well, there's more to it than just a selling point of thermal. It's worldwide recognized and it's worldwide written about how you can save energy. But there's a bigger cost to that, and it's a cost of life to that. And that point being is, from a sickness perspective, if you look at our affordable housing, for example, at the moment people are starting to install and abide to the new legislation. By having a decent thermal insulated house, a beautiful envelope house, that child or parent should not be as sick as a house without that thermal unit. Because what will happen is, the warmth that the human body generates within the house gives off heat on its own. But without that thermal, that heat will leave the house. So by having that thermal insulation in the house, the heat will stay in there in the winter months. And that family, individual, should be a lot more comfortable in that house. So it's important that these legislations are followed and it is recognized worldwide. But it's also mentioned that who's implementing these laws. At the moment, to my knowledge, it's linked to the municipality of that area, because the plans will go through that municipality, and that municipality will have their inspectors, and the BCO of that municipality will make sure the inspectors follow that process through. We are a manufacturer and a supplier to the industry, and we do our share nationally on training at our premises at Saint-Aubin. We go out and do training. We do training with architects, engineers, municipalities if we can. Deal with the Human Settlements Department, Brian Favey, on all training as much as we can offer from our side on the new building code. I hope that's answered most of the questions. Thank you.
Thank you, George.
Honourable Chair, I'd like to first, in the order the questions arise, but start with. I'll cover only two aspects, and I'll allow my learned colleague to cover the rest. The response on how George achieved, maybe let me start by saying I've just shared a document with the Honourable Chair that shows exactly how we measured the 8 megawatt. I believe the Secretary will be able to share with the rest of the Honourable Members. But my learned colleague will speak a bit more about that. I want to give a case in point. An Honourable Member asked, how can you do this elsewhere, especially in the North? Before COP17, I was personally consulting to the KZN Salga, not working in it, but sort of advising on energy efficiency and so on. And one of the 18 months before that, before the actual event, there was a mooted idea of retrofitting street lights between Bluff and Ballito, which will cover the airport, and as visitors were arriving going to the ICC, they would be able to visually see the actual LED lights on the street. And of course then the question was, our colleagues here were saying, who pays for it? The municipality distanced themselves and said, if you can find it or find a way, a mechanism to find it, by all means. And we went to the Department of Energy and back and forth until it was 6 months remaining, and the Etewini municipality said, we are prepared to do only the Etewini part. And when we started engaging on the suppliers, like the likes of Saint-Gobain, we then discovered it was too late to do it. The long and short of it is there was a fully fledged proposal that would have worked and can still work, and I would like to share it with the committee, if the chair allows us, before you finish tomorrow. That talks about the street lighting, where the municipalities would actually be involved. That talks about the incentives for the households themselves. I mean, I look at the 49M, it's made some impact, but people look at it on TV, and it's still something that they see on TV that reminds them to switch off the lights. I mean, there's an honorable member that spoke about how many of us have our office lights off. Something that incentivizes the actual household to do this without really impacting so much on their pocket. You cannot take a person who stays in a township. I was born in Umlazi, for instance. You can't take people that are still staying in the township where I was to say, if you pay 34 rands for this bulb, it will actually save you and you don't have to buy four other ones. They don't think like that, not because of any lack of capacity to think. It's just, you know, historically you want to save money. Now you're coming and you're saying, I must now spend 10 times more than I was spending on the bulb. So it's the approach to it, and the document talks to how, from the household to the municipality and, of course, to Eskom, some incentives. Now, there's hairy fairy tales about carbon credits and who has actually done it. Has anyone done it? And Sanedi will, you know, Derek Better, your colleague, will speak very passionately about that. And there's some people who claim that they have done it. And I haven't actually met someone who actually says, I've actually done a carbon credit paper and this is how it looks like. I look forward to it. that will be an ideal day. But currently, there are solutions that can be implemented, and I think Barry touched on most of those, and I would like to share those at the later. So I want to give over to my Leonard. Thank you, Chair, for the opportunity.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Just to go back to George's municipality, when we've applied for the funding in 2008, there was already, I think, 13, 14 municipalities who was in the mix to get funding from the work number 29, the Energy Efficiency and Demand Side Management. So we have not been alone in getting funding from the Department of Energy. All the big metros have received funding, and I think our five municipalities was added just as an afterthought because they thought we were too small to do anything. But be it as it may. So I think part of the agreement with the Department of Energy is that you have to have an M&B agency who is coming to do your measurement and verification. So in our instance, the lights have been counted, it has been verified, and based on what you've replaced with what, that whole energy saving has been calculated based on that, but by an independent verifier. So if I hope that is answering the first question. To say how we can roll it out to the rest of the country, I think we can not only learn from George alone, we can learn from the other bigger utilities like the City of Cape Town, like Tshwane, like City Power, like Itapeni. I think there's good projects in all those places that have been done. So yes, we are doing it like Barry was saying, it's just not coordinated, and it is not being put in a nutshell to say we have saved with 240 million, we have saved so many megawatts and so many kilowatt hours. But yes, the process is still going on, and it only started off in 2009, 2010. And what we are feeling at this stage is that this program must continue, not only for the next 3 years, but for the next 6 years, because we still believe that up to the next 6 years, we are going to have far as municipalities' unwillingness to go into energy efficiency because we are losing revenue, everything has been proposed so far to look at municipal assets. Okay, so the municipality would have not lost anything. If we are going into renewable energy and we are in the process of looking of allowing our customers to put solar PV systems onto their homes, we've been looking at deriving a tariff, and it was approved by NERSA. And yes, there is a definite way that we can see that we will lose income. We are looking very forward. The Minister of Finance, Mr. Pravin Gordhan, have stated that the increase from 2.5 cents to 3.5 cents for the environmental carbon tax levy, which are being levied by Eskom on all our customers, even by on all municipalities ourselves, must somehow be plowed back. So somehow we must invent a system that if I am saving so many kilowatt hours, that I must be able, from a municipality point of view, must be able to refund from the fiscus. And we believe that 3.5% has not been widely used so far. It was for a railway line down to Mayuva, a power station that was built as a peaking plant in the old years. But yes, I think there's definitely a mechanism already in place that we must use to ensure that the municipality is still remaining revenue neutral as far as that is concerned. If we are looking at the energy mix, a question that was asked here, now, if you are looking at the total, and I think I'm not just talking about Jordan's municipality alone, if you are talking about the full Southern Cape, Karoo area, there are basically two main transmission systems. The one is at Droerivier at Beaufort West, and the other one is at Proteus at Mossel Bay. If you are combining those two, you are talking around about 450 megawatt of load that is coming from that. Now, we've made an ambitious way to take this all forward to say that at least 50% of that must be renewable, must be base load. Okay. So if you are taking 50% or 450, you are around about 225 megawatt. Now, luckily, we also have PetroSA on our doorstep. We have done in 1998, they have approached the Southern Cape Karoo municipalities that they would have loved. At this stage, they are generating 125 megawatt of electricity for themselves. And at that stage, they were looking of generating another 200 megawatt, 100 megawatt to make sure that they don't have to import anything from Eskom, and another 100 megawatt that they could have sold to the Southern Cape Karoo municipalities. Now, I think that is still on the cards as far as base load is concerned. The 8 megawatt that we are talking that the Central Energy Fund was involved and where Environmental Carbon Options was involved, the 8 megawatt that was also a base load plant. So, yes, I believe that somewhere in the order of 200 megawatt is not unattainable in the long run. We've got, at this stage, 4 wind farms that would like to connect to Proteus, and those 4 wind farms is in the order of 300 megawatt that are either in the third window or in the fourth window of the Department of Energy / National Treasury program. I'm involved in one of them. So you are looking alone at 300 megawatt of wind that is possible at Mossel Bay / Jaws. And then we are looking at solar at around about another 50 to 60 megawatt that can be generated. So I believe the energy mix that we are proposing up to 2030 is definitely possible. I think it was the incentives are becoming in place. Really, it was refit that we were looking at. We are part of the rebid process, and we believe that we can do that. So I don't think it is totally a pipe dream can't generate 450 megawatt of electricity in the Southern Cape. I think we must also accept at this stage Eskom, with its Gorikwa power station, are generating alone 750 megawatt of electricity from kerosene. It is just very expensive at this stage. It is still at 3.68 cents a kilowatt hour. But that was meant for a peaking plant for national purposes, to ensure that if Kuwait Power, that both reactors are off, that we can still keep the power lights going. As far as smart meters are concerned, and it is for me, if your energy mix, that you are selling 50% of your energy to your domestic customer, you must be able to move or change the habits to move energy from the peaking hours down to the off-peak and to the standard. And the only way to do that is with smart meters. Now, at this stage, there's a decree from the Department of Energy stating that any customer consuming more than 1,000 kilowatt hours a month shall have a smart meter from the 1st of January 2012. And there are not many of us who are complying with that. George Municipality, we have started off with a pilot program. So we've got an approved tariff from NERSA. But yes, the uptake from our customers are not that high at this stage. And it is, you must make sure that, and that is the whole thing with the time of use domestic tariff, that both the municipality must save and the customer must save. So once you're designing the tariff, you are first designing the revenue neutral for the first year. And then from there on, once the customer is changing its consumer habits, then both parties are winning. And the national Eskom is also winning from that point. There was a question regarding the long transmission lines. I think we must accept that we in the coastal areas are being subsidized at this stage. So if you are accepting that 80% of the country's electricity is being generated up in Mpumalanga, up in those areas, and we are paying a transmission surcharge of 1%, 2%, or 3%, the 3% is not actually the full cost of electricity to provide it, for argument's sake, to the Southern Cape or down to Alassanerbaai in the Western Cape. But yes, that is pooled tariffs, what we are calling it. And we to have cost-effective tariffs for each and every individual or customer group is impossible. So we are pooling those costs within customer groups, and unfortunately sometimes you win and sometimes you lose. So I think the Southern Cape are winning for a change there. Thank you. I hope I have answered all the questions. If there is anything else, you must remind me of what I've left out there.
Thank you, honourable members, through you, Chair. The first question on the tax incentives. There's two tax incentives that are made available in conjunction with the Department of Trade and Industry and National Treasury. The first one is what's known as the 12I Industrial Tax Incentives, which is a DTI incentive. In the past, we used to try and attract foreign direct investment to industries with cheap and abundant electricity. That's why we're sitting with all the smelters in the north of KZN and so on. We don't have that cheap or abundant electricity anymore, but we still need people to invest in the country in terms of factories and putting up infrastructure so that we can create jobs. So DTI has created this incentive where bring your infrastructure or upgrade existing infrastructure to make your facilities bigger, that we can create additional jobs, but do it in an energy efficient manner. Before, we used to look for energy intensive customers like smelters that could absorb the surplus. Now we're looking for energy efficient customers. So the 12-hour tax incentive is made up on a 10-point scale. It's 10
points, you have to get 2 points for job creation, 2 points for innovation, and the list goes down. 2 points on that 10-point scale is for energy efficiency. The energy efficiency 2 points is mandatory. So you can get 8 points on all the other initiatives, but if you don't have the 2 points for energy efficiency, the project doesn't receive an incentive. These are for very big projects with an investment of 200 million rand and above, and the allocation is a 5-year period or 20 billion rand allocation from National Treasury. But this is a tax allowance, so it's foregone tax, it's not actual money paid back. So in terms of the actual impact on the fiscus, is around about 8 billion rand in real terms. That's 20 billion rand in tax foregone that we would have generated if these incentives weren't there. The 12 LTAX incentives, the regulation is currently between Treasury and the Department of Energy, and it's purely energy efficiency. For every kilowatt hour you save that can be measured and verified, you'll get a rebate of the recommended rate is 53 cents per kilowatt hour on every kilowatt hour that you've saved. And that is money directly from National Treasury that has been made available. So not part of this presentation today, we're doing the measurement and verification for the 12 LTAX incentives, and we've just done the first annual report on what has been achieved financially as well as energy-wise, and I've brought the reports for circulation to the members as a side issue and to the chair, obviously. So that's the tax incentives. And internationally, tax incentives seem to be the way to go because this is a clean, transparent mechanism. You have enabling legislation. If people default or actually take chances and try paying things that aren't there, the tax penalties or the penalties in terms of the tax legislation are quite severe. So one person you don't mess around with is the tax man. So that seems to be the trend towards a tax incentive. There's also a much fairer mechanism to provide an incentive for everyone else. On the banks, and you quite correctly say a lot of the banks do what the environmentalists call greenwashing. So they say we have these low-cost options and these financing packages, and when you try and get people like the youth, using your example, to apply for these loans, then there's all sorts of conditions. The particular ones through the three commercial banks that we're talking about, it's the venture development banks offered, or not offered, it's given an amount of money to subsidize or to buy down the cost of lending money for small and medium. This is only for small and medium-sized energy efficiency and renewable energy projects. So someone wanting to build a 100-megawatt wind farm would not qualify. So it is specifically there for the smaller industry. Yes, the banks will still have their financial criteria, but it's relaxed a lot more in terms of what is now allowed is that it's interest rates at approximately 2% below the prime lending rate. And what's the attractive part is you have a 2-year window period. So there's 2 years that you don't pay anything on the loan, so you can accumulate savings, and those savings only after year 2 you start paying back, and then you still have 10 years to pay back. So it's a very attractive option for people to lend to do projects on energy efficiency. So if someone can't access the Eskom fund or any of the other funds, and they want to do a medium-sized energy efficiency project in a factory, they could go to the banks, and they would be able to access that money. Having said that, I must mention, Chair, through you, that the International Finance Corporation are working with Sasfin Bank specifically only to provide a similar type of incentive for small and emerging energy service companies. It's going to be targeted, and it's going to have all the risk factors built in that will allow small energy service companies to access that money without all the red tape that's involved in a normal commercial bank. So that's IFC through Sasfin, and we're working with them in helping develop that package to make sure the verification in terms of the benefits are in place. Honorable Chair, the context, Professor, of the measurement and verification sitting within Eskom. What you sit with now, Eskom submits the multi-year pricing determination and they ask for a certain amount of money for energy efficiency, and that's the 5.4 billion rand that I've mentioned. The regulator approves an amount and Eskom then gets that money to implement energy efficiency projects. The regulator requires that these savings need to be verified. So we've given you an allowance to recover 5.4 billion rand from customers, but we want to make sure this money is well spent. And it's not used to run an Enkelig at 4 rand a kilowatt hour or to build a railway line to Majuba. So you have measurement and verification bodies out there. And at this stage, it's the 7 universities. And
that is a form of cheap labor, because what they use, the postgraduate students, the masters and PhD students, as part of their practical work to go out and gather all the data and do the metering and the logging and so on. And that has then been consolidated and submitted to NERSA in a transparent way, so that NERSA is quite comfortable that that money was wisely spent and the savings were achieved in terms of the carbon. That measurement and verification, or the verification body of those measurements, also sits within ESCA. And they consolidate it and they go back to the regulator. So they're the player and the referee. We believe that that measurement and verification should be out of ESCOM. ESCOM should still run the DSM funding program. They have access to all the countries across the country. They have access to all the customers. But to determine the actual savings, if we spend that money wisely, because this is public money, should not be in the same governance structure as the people are implementing it. So we believe that that should be outside of the ESCOM environment. So we believe that Synergy has got a home for that. Within the energy space, to make sure that we are in fact spending money wisely, as we are doing with the tax incentives. Then, Chair, the next question I had here was solar water heating and the seasonality of that. Unfortunately, sir, that is the case. It's totally dependent on the elements. It's dependent on the UV at any particular given time. So if you have extended periods of cloudy weather and the Western Cape has winter rain, so during the winter period, you're definitely not going to have the same performance on your solar water heating as you would in the summer period. Suffice to say, the importance of measurement and verification. We do have some cases where the installation of a solar water heater has actually increased the person's electricity consumption. Of course, in certain cases, you need to retain, and you mentioned it yourself, electricity, you need to retain your electrical geyser as a backup system. So if you have these long periods of inclement weather, that the solar water heater is not operating, that will automatically the electrical geyser will kick in and you'll have electrically heated hot water. Unfortunately, your solar water heater or your geyser is in a roof. It's something you don't physically see. You've been told you've got a solar water heater, free energy from the sun, free hot water from the sun. So you still have, like your neighbors and your family, your kids, still spend 20 minutes in the shower, have a deep bath, lie in there, because this water is free from the sun, but not realizing that it's been cloudy for the last 3 days, so the electricity geyser is working, and it's working harder than it would normally work under normal conditions. So we've had some cases where people say, but I've installed a solar water heater, but my bill has actually gone up, and it's due to human behavior, because people are just not understanding the technicality. So when we measure and verify, we must be very reluctant to say we're going to get a million solar water heaters at 3,000 megawatts. In practice, that would probably not be true, because we're not telling the true story. We're taking a deemed to satisfy. We say every solar water heater installed in the country should save 120 kilowatt hours. I might have a family of 5 children. You might have a family of 2 children. You might be living in a single household. Our water usage, our habits are different. We might bath in the morning. We might bath in the evening. That depends on the peak periods where you said where the grass was shown by George, depending on when the water usage is consumed. So it is definitely a seasonal technology, and that is not communicated as it should be done in good practice. The card being used in hotels, I know the Minister of Energy and the previous Minister of Energy have been fighting for years for the hospitality sector to introduce this technology. We travel internationally, and the smallest of small hotels, the smallest of small towns, the Riversdale of Europe, the hotel has got a master key, which is your entry card. When you take it out, the everything switches off. We are seeing now the hotels, due to cost pressures, and Southern Sun are already rolling it out in their new hotels, and some of them are actually doing retrofits. In the household application for you and I, that probably is not the ideal way, because we don't want to walk around with plastic cards, but technology is developing at such a rate that a very simple sensor, motion sensor, to be installed, like we used to have for our security lighting outside, when movement is picked up, the lights go on. In offices, we see more and more offices. Our office, for example, has a 20-minute sensor. If someone is not in that office or is not moving in that office, the person could be there and having a nap, and the boss walks past, and if the lights are off, you know the person hasn't moved for 20 minutes. But in practice, if you leave the office after 20 minutes, if there's no movement, the lights will shut off. And it's a little sensor, very cheap, very easy to install,
and the Green Building Council in their rating system does actually promote that in a big way. And that's a simple, very easy opportunity that one can employ. On the glazing, I just want to add to my colleagues from Saint-Gobain. Windows, and after attending this conference, and just think about it, it's something that we take a window as something to just look out to see outside. But in terms of energy and the impact on energy, it's a phenomenal impact. The lady mentioned about heating the house and cooling the house. Ideally, what you need, and it's a no-cost option, virtually, and people don't take this into consideration, you need to allow as much daylight in as possible, whether it's through a window or daylight, a scanner. So having enough windows and allowing daylight in is ideal. Take the example here. It's the middle of the day. We've closed the curtains and we switch on the lights. That's not the ideal thing to do. We could probably open the windows and switch off the lights and save a lot of energy. The same applies at home. But now, as my colleagues from Saint-Gobain said, you have the summer situation where you have all this glass and then you have a heat build up in the house. By planting a deciduous tree in front of that window, what it does is, in summer, it has all its leaves and it provides natural shading and it's a natural barrier to allowing the sunlight in. In winter, it loses all its leaves and then you just have these branches and it allows natural light in. That's a non-mechanical way of optimizing your heating, your daylight, and your cooling in summer and winter by planting the right tree. And planting trees in our areas has got an environmental benefit. And that doesn't, you don't have to put double glazing, triple glazing, or anything like that. Very simple. A lot of these things, and I've said some people on measurement and verification see it as rocket science. If we go back to basics, a lot of the stuff's just common sense, and it doesn't have to cost us an arm and a leg. And one of those options, and that can be in a low-cost household, it can be in a high-cost, high-income house. So, Chair, these are just some of the tips. There's many more. I do want to just touch on, and I see all my colleagues have avoided this for, I'm not sure what reason, but the daylight savings, which you brought up, about daylight savings. Everywhere in the world, or not everywhere, a lot of places in the world, you have daylight savings where you move the clock an hour or 2 hours in winter and summer. Around about the 60s, I believe a study was done in South Africa to look at daylight savings. It wasn't for energy savings at that time. It was just for economic reasons, and it was proved not to be feasible. Fairly recently, actually in 2008, when we had the load shedding, you might recall Kulula.com had a big drive to reintroduce daylight savings. They believe there'd be energy savings, but it actually has a bigger benefit on the cycling of the aircraft between Johannesburg and Cape Town particularly. So they had a big drive, they lobbied government, the aeroplanes had a lot of branding on it about promote daylight savings, their website was trying to encourage people to support them by way of a poll. And once again, the study was done and it proved that the disadvantages in comparison to the benefits of introducing daylight savings were higher. So there are benefits, without a doubt, scientifically proven we will have energy benefits. But in terms of the change in the banking system and everything else, which is very inextricably linked in South Africa, would create some problems. So those studies are available and I'll try source them and through the Secretary I'll pass them onto the committee. I must say that if you talking to people all over the world, if you speak, and some countries have actually stopped daylight savings, if you done a random poll of people around the world on the benefits of daylight savings, I'm quite confident that you would get 50% in favour and 50% not in favour. It's just one of those things that it's not a clear-cut decision, yay or no. And it might warrant some additional research for South African conditions, given the current changing climate that we're experiencing. So, Chair, I think I've covered all the questions that were posed. And we'd like, once again, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, to thank you very much for indulging us in this, what we believe is an exciting but a very important area.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. Just before we break, can I give you the three of the presenters the few things to respond thereafter? The first one is it possible from San Kobin to have the thermal insulation application joining us towards the end of the presentation? not that I don't take the card of your input, but it would be extremely helpful to have a global picture of what you people in the human interaction want to do. You've given us a model as one company, but it would be helpful to have a global picture. The Honourable Smith, this touches on a number of things. Energy efficient housing, for instance, retrofitting. One of the things I've picked up is that it's fine to talk about retrofitting, but to what extent are we grappling with retrofitting for the poor? Because the kind of materials and innovations that are being expressed here are definitely more appropriate for the middle income people. The lower rung, you know, RDPs are still rolled out. The extent to which the current situation can take them into account, as articulated here, there's a bit of a challenge there. But not that you haven't indicated to an extent, but all I'm saying, I'm biased. I want us to be robust in that area. Honourable members, we've been to Atlantis. We saw what can be done in designing now, because the energy efficient designs that we saw in Atlantis are actually at design level. But the brilliance that's brought in by Saint-Gobain is about also retrofitting, because there are already millions of houses, RCP houses in particular, because that's where how much did you say, 2.5 billion to the spiritual problem, you know. Even just the house being cozy. I'm raising that on that basis. As you said, creation of jobs, obviously that triggers interest on us. Has there been anyone who has worked out any guesstimate, I emphasize? Do you have any case studies in any case in that area? The department is represented here. I take in that at some stage they can respond to some of the issues that you are recommending, you know, that is the retrofitting program. But the emphasis for me is in as comprehensive a manner as is possible, you know, because there are various areas. Also, with regards to job creation, you say jobs have been created in the retrofitting program, or by retrofitting programs, more than generating electricity. Where has that been done? So it would be helpful to have a sense of that. There's a NEDLEC report, which I trust and hope the committee secretary could source from NEDLEC and share with members, because it reminds me of how much the country spends on tobacco-related diseases, how much the country spends on killing the people who have been through accidents, you know, particularly road accidents. Those are sort of hidden costs within government, which compels not only the government, it asks the citizens of this country to start, you know, changing our behavior. Such that we don't spend too much of the money on health care due to respiratory diseases. You know, different ways of investing, you know, on our better life. Sorry about that. I'd like to address municipality to repeat what they said, that there's no protection from ESCOM onwards. You know, it attracted me stronger on that. I didn't write at the fact, unfortunately. I see. In terms of your profiling, your load profiling, you've just taken monthly and weekly tests. Just out of interest and curiosity, why not daily tests? Because there is a issue from time to time, you know, when you look at peak times, you know, on a daily basis. feels good to me that most of my questions have been addressed, you know, on the church side. Safe to say that we were going to do our level best to make sure that Falca, you know, comes in to give us a broader picture in terms of the areas you've given. But the work that George Municipality has given is quite commendable. I'm sure when we also look at energy and climate change issues, one of the numbers, we can pull in the municipality again, but I sense that there could be also perhaps one of the models where we can draw lessons for that, because there's a very strong link between energy and climate change to that. And as you say, energy efficiency can encompass a far broader spectrum than extracting electrical energy, but you don't elaborate. In fact, in sunrise this morning, I saw a lady being shown how to drive a car efficiently. I hope we are together on that. On measurement and verification, to what extent can smart grid assist on that? In terms of the International Finance Corporation and Sustainable Joint Initiative, the question I have, you think of Sustain outright private entity, and you still speak of ISP, which is an international initiative. Then the question I have, what about our own national and provincial DFI, Development Finance Initiative? Are they doing something? Have they been approached? Are they thinking of something up to your African Development and Ethnicity? I think for all the three, particularly just municipality and planning, much as I appreciate what you have said, I haven't heard you saying anything about public participation or enhancement of public participation, because amongst other things, promoting energy efficiency includes changes in behavior, social behavior at home, and even at work, the extent to which that has been part of your program on the overall, particularly in Masbala, with all the 250,000 customers. Honourable members, I know we've driven a little bit beyond the break, but apologies. I'm sure I could sense everyone was excited. Honourable, if you could just ask so that during this time they can prepare their response.
Thank you, Jay. It will be short. The uptake from the various incentive schemes that there is, the tax incentives and ESCOM, what was the actual take-up of that, just to see the participation? Is there some sort of research being done on it? Thank you very much.
Honourable members, can we take a break? Thank you.